You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
Good evening and welcome to The Lyric Feature. On today's programme, the story of the Pogues' second album, Rum, Sodomy and The Lash, which turns 40 this year. A Dream of Foreign Lands is presented by Mike Brennan.
How are you?
You need that raincoat, do you?
Yeah.
Might start raining.
Well, might start raining. Listen, are you a Kayleigh band, Shane McGowan? Yeah. Or are you a ballad group? Or are you a punk rock outfit? Or what are you?
Well, we're all of them, really, yeah.
Your performances, it says here, have been described as sordid, rowdy and vulgar. All the intelligence
of that class, the newspaper. Rowdy music, violent music, sort of drunken sessions and that. In name of Irish music is a terrible abortion.
Well,
it's a terrible abortion.
What about the complaints and the criticisms of you that you're sort of bringing Irish music into disrepute and you're playing up the Paddy and the drunken Paddy image and so on?
In September 1985, the Pogues were first introduced to a mainstream Irish audience through their debut Late Late Show performance. While widely faded in Ireland today, the band's emergence was met with confusion or hostility by many within the Irish media. Just what was this strange blend of Irish tradition and London punk? What was this rowdy, vulgar music? Were these people bringing Ireland and Irish music into disrepute? In contrast, the band were establishing deep and significant connections with audiences, what has been described as a forged steel pact of unquestioning loyalty that went much further than audience participation. Emerging from a London King's Cross scene through 1983 and 1984, the Pogues' early fan base contained large numbers of London Irish amongst its ranks. For this audience, the band offered an expression of what it was to be second-generation Irish in England. Throughout 1985, the band's reputation would continue to build, and with the release of their second album, Rum, Sodomy and the Lash, they would attain widespread success. Rum, Sodomy and the Lash is both a dark and joyful work. It addresses themes of violence, poverty and depravity in unflinching form. It also contains moments of wild exuberance and abandon. It stands as an illustration of the band and their principal songwriter Shane McGowan at the peak of their creative powers. The Pogues' lyrics often spotlighted exiled, marginalised, wounded or damaged individuals, and their audience often contained within it those who felt, for one reason or another, excluded or disenfranchised, who found solidarity within the band's work. For many Dublin music fans, their first sense of this solidarity arrived when the band played their first Dublin headline show at the city's McGonagall's venue on March 1st, 1985. Michael McCaughan was entertainment officer in Trinity College Dublin when he received a call asking him to set up the Pogues' first headline Irish tour.
At some point, a bunch of merchandise arrived in my office from the Pogues. The Pogues now, at this stage, it's hard to believe now, but their first album, Red Roses For Me, was released without much fanfare. And there were kind of question marks and maybe a kind of an attitude about who these upstarts might be trying to play trad, but being a bit punky and maybe disrespecting the tradition, which, of course, was a pack of more mealtach, a big sin back in the day. These posters arrived with all the Red Roses For Me, just lovely bunches of red roses in a posters, which went up in my office. And I listened to the album. And of course, the first thing that comes through is the energy of the first album. And then the lyrics, and you realize there's a complexity there. And so that's all that we knew at that point when I got a phone call from Frank Murray, who was the manager of the Pogues. Frank, they said to me very straight, like, we want 4 crates of Guinness. It's going to be £800 per gig. And there were 5 gigs to be organised. So without knowing how exactly it was going to happen, but knowing I had the backing of Trinity, I said, absolutely great. And the Pogues at that stage were getting a name as a live, energetic live band. You know, the news was filtering through that this was a band that would appeal to students and punks and music fans. And also I realised as the days approached that the tickets were starting to sell very quickly by the standards. You know, back then people walked up and bought tickets at the door to gigs. Buying ahead of time wasn't that common. So as I checked in on the places I left tickets, it became apparent that up to 80% of the tickets were gone with a few days to go to the gig. And this was really unusual. And so all these stories came in then about what might happen on the night then, because we'd heard that Shane McGowan had had part of his ear bitten off at a Clash gig. And, you know, there was Spider and the tray and the banging and the craziness and the alcohol and the sense of them being somewhat of an outlaw band. Walking distance from Trinity College, very much a central Dublin gig venue. It was fairly scruffy, it was pretty cheap, and it was utterly handy to anyone in and around Dublin. And so it was a sellout gig, and yet lots of people were at the door, and then there were people who, of course, I knew half of Dublin, so everybody would come up to me and say, look, can you just get me in? I couldn't get a ticket and this, that and the other. There was this kind of sense of this mounting crowd outside that, you know, it was going to be a slightly out of control event and that a lot of people wanted to get in who we wouldn't have room for. Of course, all the hot press and the rest of the media crowd were coming along too. So there was just electricity in Dublin that day, you know. And then, of course, the band has to come into sound check and so on and so forth. So the whole thing is just this little sense of a nice simmering storm about to happen. As soon as the band hit the stage, the crowd went bananas and the gap between the crowd and the stage and the group fell apart immediately. I was trying to hold speakers up. There were friends of mine trying to stop people getting crushed. Anyway, they were in full flow and, you know, it was that nice time with the Pogues. It's easy to get nostalgic and that, but this is at a time when they really wanted to prove themselves to an Irish audience. This audience mattered to them massively. And you could see beforehand that they were really focusing on their gig and their music and that, and they played their hearts out.
Jem Finer and James Fernley of the band offer these reflections upon the reception they received on that first Irish headline tour. Jem Finer.
It wasn't hostile. There might have been some bemusement from some people, and there was definitely some enthusiasm. It certainly wasn't like, you know, the entry of Christ into Jerusalem and everyone going completely bonkers. But I'd say it was positive, largely positive. I think we were nervous about how we might be received, but I certainly think that nervousness was slightly misplaced. I think, you know, we came away thinking, yeah, this is good. You know, we can come here again. People seem to like it. But, you know, there's no denying that there were people in Ireland who thought what we were doing was pretty disrespectful, which I'm sorry about because, you know, that wasn't our intention.
James Fernley.
All that concern, all that self-doubt and everything was totally laid to waste. To see the enthusiasm in which a Dublin crowd got for the music that we were playing. I mean, all those, you know, whether we were plastic paddies or... I mean, you know, I'd never even thought about it. I wasn't ready. Basically. I just wasn't ready to take that on at all.
After the McGonagall's gig, the Pogues returned to London and are working on the material that would make up their second album. For many music fans, the title of this album rolls off the tongue in similar fashion to other classic album titles. Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, Purple Rain, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Familiarity has perhaps somewhat dimmed the visceral impact of the title Rum, Sodomy and the Lash. It referred to Winston Churchill's description of life in the Royal Navy. Churchill is said to have used the phrase in 1913 when he was first Lord of the Admiralty. Having apparently been accused of having impugned the traditions of the Royal Navy, Churchill replied, "And what are they? They are rum, sodomy and the lash." The decision to adopt this phrase as an album title stemmed from the band's drummer Andrew Rankin. Andrew was unable to make a verbal contribution to this documentary, but he did share the following written contribution. Within it, Andrew also reflects upon the album's themes and the band's connection both to London and to Ireland. The title comes from Winston Churchill's description of life in the British Navy, possibly brought to mind by George Melly's rather more frivolously titled autobiography, Rum, Bum and Concertina. I can't remember the exact circumstances, but I think I must have quoted it during a conversation where we were fishing around for what to call the album. It seemed to ring a few bells, and I think it resonated with several of the album's recurring themes. Thematically, I think it is a dark album, with death, war, drink and destruction all to the fore, to which may be added exploitation, both capitalist and sexual, and an overall sense of painful and needless loss. As for the band's connection with London, I would always describe us as a London band. That is where we met, where we lived, and where it all started. We were part of the London music scene before anyone else had ever heard of us. The London Irish helped spread the word, of course, though as in Ireland there was some criticism initially that we were not really authentic, not Irish enough, and not playing our instruments properly enough. This misses the point that we were a London band, and although we had some Irish roots and a shared love for Irish music, we were also heavily influenced by punk and to some extent country and western, and never wanted to simply copy Irish traditional music. We were trying to do something new and hopefully with a broader appeal. Some people got it and some didn't. Importantly though, I think we played a role of political solidarity and support for the Irish community in London and the UK generally at a time when it was beleaguered by Thatcher and the Conservative government and our hideous right-wing press. When we started doing St. Patrick's Day concerts, and any gigs at all in fact, it always felt to me that a huge collective sigh of relief went up because we were making a very positive statement about our Irish influences and demonstrating that it was possible to do that and to have an enormous amount of fun at the same time. Long may that continue. Having settled on the album title Rum, Sodomy and the Lash, the band turned to Theodore Jericho's 1818 painting The Raft of the Medusa as a source for the album artwork, collaging band members' faces onto characters in Dada-esque punk fashion. The Raft of the Medusa depicts the aftermath of the wreck of the French naval ship which ran aground off the West African coast on July 2nd, 1816. Although the Medusa was carrying 400 people, there was only space for about 250 in its lifeboats. At least 146 passengers, primarily the ship's lower-ranking crew, were piled onto a hastily built raft and set adrift. According to the critic Jonathan Miles, the raft carried the survivors to the frontiers of human experience. Crazed, parched and starved, they slaughtered mutineers, ate their dead companions and killed the weakest. By the time they were rescued, only 15 were left alive. Jem Finer recalls how this particular image found its way onto the album cover.
There was an idea to find some nautical themed cover, and Marcia, my wife, she's an artist and art historian, and she said, a really great painting that's got a very Pogues-like sort of history to it is The Raft of the Medusa by Jericho, and showed me this reproduction. And then told me about the story, you know, because it's about this story of there was a shipwreck And they sort of built a raft, and people were put on this raft, and they were meant to be towed. But basically, they were, you know, they were sort of cast off and left to drift, and ended up having to eat each other. And it was one of those terrible things where it was like all the higher ranking people escaped in the proper lifeboats, and they were just sort of left to. So it was a kind of story that felt like it could have almost been a Pogues song. So I took this picture along, and everyone went, yeah, yeah, this is great. And then there's this idea to stick our heads on it.
James Fernley.
Why we should want to fold that story of identifying with those ones that have been cast adrift, I'm not sure. I'm in two minds. I think it's a very arresting image. And of course, the story is horrifying because the cannibalism and whatever, and death and starvation and drowning and despair. Yeah, I understand all those, but I'm not sure that as a statement on the front of a record, it is all that truthful to where we're coming from, or we were coming from. On that level, not sure. On another level of putting our faces in other people, on other people's heads, in one of the most famous paintings in the world, that's massive and that's in the Louvre and is a national treasure. The piss take of that is fucking amazing, to do something like that and get away with it, because it's funny as all get out. As an image, it is, it's unstoppable. I think it was really, really great to do that.
Rum, Sodomy and the Lashes, Winston Churchill quoting title, and Jericho quoting artwork are but two examples of the references to historical, mythological, literary, art history, musical and geographical sources that feature throughout the album. Lyrical references to John McCormack, Johnny Cash, Jesse James, Philomena Begley, Banshees and Battlefields. Nowhere is this more apparent than on the album's opening track, The Sick Bed of Cuchulainn. The song's opening line references John McCormack and the Austrian Jewish tenor Richard Tauber. Tauber fled Austria in 1938 following the Nazis' withdrawal of his family's passports. From the very opening moments of the album, thus, we're in a world where conflict, music and exile clash and coincide.
McCormack and Richard Tauber are singing by the bed. There's a glass of punch below your feet and an angel at your head. There's devils on each side of you with bottles in their hand. You need one more drop of poison and you'll dream of foreign land.
Historian Donal Fallon.
The Sick Bed of Cuchulainn is a perfect album opener because it builds quite slowly, and it also recalls for me Transmetropolitan on the first album. There are things about it that are similar. Both of them mention specific places in London. So in this song we have the Euston Tavern. There's something really Joycean about the way Shane McGowan brings you across London in Pogue songs. And of course, McGowan was obsessed with Joyce. A copy of Finnegan's Wake was on the altar at his funeral. But I love that the first tracks on the first and second album both place us geographically in London. The Euston Tavern and the windows being kicked in or blown out. It's a really, really powerful opening. It also does something that McGowan likes to do, which is peppering songs with references to historic individuals or literary figures. So we get that throughout this song as well. And I think the inclusion of Frank Ryan says a lot about Shane McGowan and Shane McGowan's politics. Frank Ryan, of course, had led the Irish contingent who fought in the Spanish Civil War. So we get, not only do we get Frank Ryan, but we get a showdown against the backdrop of the war in Spain in a brothel in Madrid, nonetheless.
When you pissed yourself in Frankfurt and got sipped down in Cologne, and you heard the rattling death trains as you lay there all alone, Frank Ryan bought you whiskey in a brothel in Madrid, and you text some fucking black shirt who was cursing all the yids, and a sick bit of Cuchulainn will kneel and say a prayer, but it goes the rattling at the door and the devil's in that chair.
The literary influences are really worn on the sleeve of the first album in a big way. So even on the very first track with a KMRIA, Kiss My Royal Irish Arse, you know, taken directly from Ulysses, the lines from Brendan Behan in the first album are very clear and very strong. The second album, there's historical references, far more than literary references, that we find throughout the album, right down to the album cover, The Raft of Medusa. But the way people like Count John McCormack and Frank Ryan are evoked, we're getting more into the historical head than the literary head of McGowan on the second album.
Shane McGowan later said of Sickbed of Cuchulainn and of Frank Ryan's place within it, Frank Ryan was a socialist Republican. He went to fight in the Spanish Civil War and he got captured. The song's about a similar kind of character, except he's an old dosser and he's dying. He lives longer than Frank Ryan. He lives to be an old man. It's about how every old dosser you see on the street has got a history. He's got a history of probably fighting in a couple of world wars. Maybe the Spanish Civil War. The character from that is an Irish guy who's fought in all the wars that Frank Ryan fought in, and that's why it mentions Frank Ryan. This empathy with the dosser, the downtrodden, the emigrant, the exile, those set adrift, the injured, the wounded, the outsider, is a recurring characteristic of Rum, Sodomy and the Lash and of the Pogues' broader body of work, and is perhaps rooted in the band's own outsider status. As Jem Finer recalls, the band themselves were a collection of individuals who each had their own experiences of exclusion and marginalisation.
We all came from very different backgrounds, but a lot of us in our own ways had had sort of experience of being outsiders in some way and disparaged too. Like, my father's Jewish and I, you know, got a lot of abuse at times at school, you know, for being Jewish or for, you know, my mother wasn't Jewish, but people still will, they, your dad's Jewish, they want to have a go at you, they pick up on it. So, you know, we all in our own ways had this experience of what it feels like to be abused, really, be treated as outsiders.
Former Pogues bass player Cadhg Reardon, on a recent episode of RTE programme Creedon's Musical Atlas of Ireland, recalled her experience of growing up as a second-generation Irish kid in 1970s London.
I grew up near Heathrow Airport, out under the flight path, and like we were the kids whose parents talked funny, and it was really horrible. Just the racism and the stress of it all, and you know, just having a name nobody could pronounce. Just, we were very much made to feel we didn't fit in. You know, if there'd been no aggro about the names or my parents' accents or about, oh, you Irish terrorist scumbags, if there hadn't been any of that, we'd have grown up wired completely differently, but we were subjected to racism.
The band thus held a strong attraction for those who felt similarly marginalised or excluded. Cathro Doherty is an arts editor and cultural critic based in New York. He recalls the appeal the Pogues held for him growing up in Ireland in the 1980s.
You definitely had a lot of people who policed your identity, who told you you're not truly Irish if you don't do X, you're not truly Irish if you don't do Y. And they'd police your accent, where you came from. And even if you're from the next county, you would find this balkanization thing going on, which is just counterintuitive and counterproductive and a waste of time. And the Pogues didn't do that. They gathered a bunch of disparate people, truly disparate people, put them all together under one banner. Said, this is Irish, this is punk, this is all welcoming. You can come here if you want, you can have the time of your life, and this is for all. That was new. That just wasn't happening at the time. I was gay as well in the 1980s. I believed that U2 was as a young teenager in the 1980s, U2 was an older straight boys band. It was your brother's band, you know, your older brother's band. It wasn't us. It didn't look like us, didn't sound like us, didn't really offer us a welcome. There was nothing much going on in those lyrics that spoke to anybody other than the straightest, whitest people of the period. And I couldn't get a purchase on them at all for years. But I immediately understood the Pogues. I saw the welcome of the Pogues. I glommed onto them, as many gay kids did at the period, but everyone else did too. It was a more welcoming idea of being Irish at the time. It wasn't mysticism and standing on a peak. You know, it wasn't the unforgettable fire or any of that. It was far more literary and accessible.
Not everyone, however, found the Pogues welcoming and accessible, nor indeed welcomed their arrival. The history of music is littered with confrontations between traditionalists or purists who seek to preserve musical forms in their so-called pure state, and those who seek to stretch them in new directions, to incorporate new elements, influences, or instrumentation. In 1965, the folk singer Pete Seeger famously threatened to take an axe to the cables of Bob Dylan's performance at the Newport Folk Festival, incensed that Dylan was performing with electric guitars and instrumentation, an apparent betrayal of his acoustic folk club origins. At a UK concert months later, a crowd member shouted Judas at Dylan, again incensed by his full band electric performance. For some in Ireland, the Pogues' fusion of traditional Irish influences with punk attitude and energy was similarly unwelcome. It was made even more so by the fact that this was a band who had emerged from London and spoke with English accents. The hostility that surrounded the band in certain quarters found its most notorious expression during a broadcast of RT Radio 2's show The BP Fallon Orchestra, recorded on September 5th, 1985, mere weeks after the release of Rum Sodomy and the Lash, and at which point interest in the band was rapidly accelerating. Fallon assembled an audience of around 40 for the broadcast, members of the public, the media, and of the Irish musical community. The Pogues' ranks were swelled by two new members, Phil Chevron, formerly of Dublin punk band The Radiators from Space, and Terry Woods, a veteran of groups including Sweeney's Men, Steel Eye Span, and The Woods Band. The band were also joined by their manager Frank Murray. Perhaps the most notorious moment of the broadcast came during the following exchange with the noted traditional concertina player, Noel Hill.
Is there anybody here who thinks that the Pogues, not being sort of thoroughbred Paddy Power, should not actually play Irish music, that they actually regard them
we
as...
We don't play Irish music, really. I mean, we do play Irish...
We don't
exclusively play Irish music.
Noel Hill, I mean, you're an accordion player, a traditional musician with a lot of credence. I mean, what do you think of the Pogues?
When I read things about the Pogues and saying the hottest thing... hottest band in Irish music.
Yes, well, so, the main,
I mean, yeah,
they don't say that.
It's
they don't
right.
say that. That's what the press say. The press misconstrue everything.
So any of you don't claim to be Irish musicians, then you're
I'm not an Irish musician.
Music.
I'm not Irish.
Yeah. The thing is, you'll have Brendan Shine, you'll have all the people like the Dubliners and the Clanchbrothers and all of those people with the Irish music label. And it's the most bastardized of all the musics in this country. But this music that came out of, we'll say, 20 years ago, out of pubs in Dublin, rowdy music, ballad music, came out of drunken sessions and that. Being labelled Irish music is a terrible abortion of the world.
Well,
a terrible, terrible abortion of the world.
Donal Fallon.
What happens on this radio show is a debate that in traditional music is as old as time. This had happened with the Chieftains. I mean, Sean O'Riordan had argued that the Chieftains had broken with Irish traditional music culture. This happens later on with bands like Planxty. And it happens in the ballad boom in a very big way in the 60s. And now it's happening with the Pogues. In the audience, you have Noel Hill, who's a legendary concertina player. And he talks about the Pogues in this tradition of what he calls, I think, rowdy ballad music. And he's saying that they're akin to the Dubliners who had come before. By the 1980s, people in their minds thought about the Dubliners as part of the folk canon. So they heard the Dubliners and the Pogues lumped in together as some kind of anomaly of traditional music. It was quite strange, I think, to younger ears. The exact words that he uses, I think, will never be forgotten by anyone who was in the studio. He refers to the music of the Pogues as being akin to a terrible abortion. And there's this idea, this reoccurring point being made from the floor that these young people are disrespecting traditional music. And you can hear a lovely moment in the recording where there's a distinctly London accent claiming, "I never said I was Irish." And that really captures something that's going on at the very heart of this. Are these young people even claiming to be Irish? I would argue that they're not. They're a quintessentially London Irish band, which is a different thing entirely. But the question of what they mean for Irish music is playing out in a very tense way in that studio.
The band were also accused of paying PR to falsely play up their Irish connections.
Sammy Smith from the Sunday World, you wanted to ask a question.
Yeah, I'm just saying the boys are sitting here, they're in Dublin, they're after singing Irish songs and songs about Ireland. They pay money to publicists who plug their Irishism and Irish antecedents. Then they complain about being described as an Irish band. Why?
I think you're mistaken, actually.
Yeah, it's completely...
You're saying some of the songs are traditional Irish songs. But they're not all aside from those, they're not all songs about being Irish. That's your own interpretation.
Later on, when the Pogues were asked about this interview, Andrew made a great point where he drew comparison to what had happened to the Sex Pistols. And when the Sex Pistols were confronted on a television chat show, they really ran with it. And the Pogues are doing something quite similar. And Philip Chevron also hit on something very profound about that moment. He said that when he joins the band, and when Frank Murray's around the band, and Terry Woods as well later on, that changes how this band are viewed, and no longer could they be condemned as plastic paddies, in Phil's words. But there's a degree of that going on, that this is a plastic paddy band pretending to be Irish.
Elsewhere, it was suggested that some of the artists the band had referenced, either in song or in interview, were contemptuous, provoking an impassioned rebuke from Shane McGowan.
Gentleman over there at the back of the audience.
My name is Pat Walsh. Just from what they were saying before there, there's a line in a pair of Bone Eyes where he says about Ray and Phil singing of My Elusive Dreams. Well, that's Ray Lynam and Finnebile Begley. Well, I can accept that. But I have a quotation here from Shane. He said, I'd rather have Brendan Shine than the Thompson Twins. I'd rather have Foster and Allen than Howard Jones and Nick Kershaw or the Eurythmics. Well, Ray Lynam and Finnebile Begley is one thing, but Foster and Allen and Brendan Shine, they're the worst aspects of Irish music.
Actually comparing them to Irish music, to the rest of Irish music, what I was saying was in the English charts, right?
Yeah.
And, like, there is something, like, what, you know, I happen to like Brendan Shine and Foster and Allen, right? I also like, you know,
Well, it's better hard for us to take that.
If you want to be a... but whatever you
want. No, they are all. You know. I mean, you can't...
I was saying that if you're going to have pap, right, you know...
Yeah.
That's right? The kind of pap he wants.
Right? I'm saying that it's pap, right?
Yeah.
Because I don't think Foster and Brendan Shine are pap, because...
Yeah.
But that's what you're saying there, yeah?
Yeah.
But, like...
Yeah.
I don't think they're pat because I think they appeal to the
side.
To something within anybody who's prepared to be unpretentious and not be afraid of being sentimental or passionate or whatever, angry, sad, happy, whatever, you know what I mean?
While people are arguing, what are they? What do they mean for traditional Irish music? You really get a sense of just how broad the tastes and influences of the Pogues are. That Shane takes offence at the talking down of country music and show band music and all of that in the discussion too. And music like Brendan Shine, and there is that great moment of debate around Brendan Shine, that's music that held a very deep emotional importance to the Irish diaspora. I mean, venues in London today that are packed for indie bands were often built as dance halls for the Irish community. And show band music and country music, that was all very, very important. Arguably, that was as important in County Kilburn as it was in County Donegal. So the fact that McGowan comes to the defence of Brendan Shine and music like that, that says a lot about that second generation Irish identity.
At the source of much of the criticism levelled at the Pogues during the BP Fallon broadcast is the manner in which they fused Irish folk and traditional music with new influences. Punk, rockabilly, country, literary influences, urban and contemporary observations. A potent example of this approach is the song The Old Main Drag. The Old Main Drag, in many ways, sits within a broader tradition of Irish emigrant songs. The Mountains of Mourne, Spancel Hill, Paddy on the Railroad, wherein a young male protagonist finds himself forced to carve out a life in a foreign land. The narrator within The Old Main Drag, however, does not write wistful letters home, dream of his one and only love, or find work upon the railroad. Rather, he finds himself within a world of prostitution, pills, police violence and abuse. The song relocates the Irish emigrant ballad within a space that is more Lou Reed than it is Luke Kelly. As Shane's sister, the author Siobhan McGowan, recalls, the song is rooted in young Shane McGowan's observations of London's West End.
When Shane was about 17 or whatever, like that, he started to go down to Piccadilly Circus. And he was always very attracted to the underside of life, like, you know. So he would watch the homeless people, the prostitutes, people not making it, sitting there lost, you know. And he was very drawn to all that. He really felt for them, I think. And especially, like, the old... He's talking about there, like, a man who's lived his life of regret and he's been shat on and spat on and raped and abused and he's dying. And I think those are all things that would have really touched Shane. Like, you know, he could very easily have put himself in that position. He had great empathy. And... he would have seen that and he would have really felt it. Like, there wasn't much he could do about it because he was penniless himself at the time, you know, so he couldn't have done too much about it. Later on, he used to give wads and wads of cash, like, to home. I mean, wads of cash to homeless people, or anybody on the street. But he couldn't do too much at that time. So he was very, very drawn to those characters, and he could very well imagine how they might be feeling, especially when, you know, you probably saw, and you do see them, the old men, like, dribbling, and they've got their bottle of vodka by them, and they're half in and half out of it, like, you know. So he's watching them, and he's putting himself in his position and documenting it in his way that, you know. So that's what it was like. It was like that around King's Cross as well. So it would have been things that were very close to his heart, and he actually never actually lost. He always stayed interested in that, and always didn't really lose that empathy. He certainly didn't lose the empathy, but he didn't lose the interest in expressing it either.
When I first came to London, I was only 16, with a fiver in my pocket and my old dancing bag. I went down to the Dilly to check out the scene, but I soon ended up upon the old main drag. There the he-males and the she-males paraded in style, and the old man with the money would flash you a smile. In the dark of an alley, you would work for a five, for a swift one, not the rest, down on the old main drag. In the cold winds and nights, the old town it was chill, but there were boys in the cafes who'd give you cheap pills. If you didn't have the money, you could join and you'd beg. There was always lots of chewing all on the old main drag.
Carol Dart.
Not every story that went to London ended happily. Not everybody went over and got a job on the building site, built a home, got a wife, and sent money back to the family. There's as many Irish people that disappeared into the night there as there were people who succeeded in other ways. And this story, like, the old main drag is about rent boys, Piccadilly, and the underside of London. And it's about shame. And it's about loneliness, isolation, and abandonment. It's about all of those things. And it's about bodies being sold for money in a different kind of way. And it's about lovelessness. And he saw that. He's holding the mirror up to our experiences, the things we don't talk about, the great silences of Irish life. And he's saying, look at this. This is you too. This happens. What do you make of this? And he's celebrating in song and lamenting in song, you know, lives that vanish, that people that just walked between the raindrops and never came back. And that was the song for me that was like, holy God, this is a good band. This is like nothing I've seen. And, you know, if we are talking about accessing stories that were just not told anywhere else, and we're doing it in the middle of the 1980s, in the middle of the AIDS panic, in the middle of the hatred directed toward the gay community, a long-standing ancient one, hatred. And he's holding up like a prayer and, you know, he's a witness for an experience that people just didn't want to talk about or even pretend they knew at the time.
One evening as I was lying down in Leicester Square, I was picked up by the coppers and kicked in the balls. Between the metal doors at Vine Street, I was beaten and mauled, and I ruined my good looks for the old main drag. In the tube station, the old ones who were on the way out would dribble and vomit and grovel and shout, and the coppers would come along and push them about. And I wished I could escape from the old main drag, and now I am lying here. I have had too much booze. I've been spat on and shat on and raped and abused.
I know that I am dying, and I wish I could beg for some money to take me from the old main track.
Perhaps Rum Sodomy and the Lash's most visceral, political and explicit anti-war moment comes with its final track, a cover of Eric Bogle's 1971 composition, and the band played Waltzing Matilda. Over 8 relentless minutes, the song follows the fate of its protagonist from youth to old age, from a carefree life roaming the Australian outback through conscription and the horrors of Gallipoli. Cauto Reardon, speaking in 2013 for the Century Ireland Project, recalled how the song found its way into the Pogues' repertoire.
During the 80s, when I was a teenager, the song was in the air. I think in the 70s, June Tabor had started singing it around the folk circuit, and we were kind of tangentially attached to that circuit. But also, I think the Clancy Brothers and the Furies had been covering Bogle's military songs, The Green Fields of France, and the band played Waltzing Matilda. So it was just, it was a song that was in the air and it was in the repertoire. And I was thinking about why did it mean so much to us? And I think because it was such a political time. And of course, the Falkland War was on, or the Malvinas War, as we were calling it. And the song just resonated so much. And of course, Bogle wrote it after the Vietnam War. And he used Gallipoli in the First World War for the timelessness of it. And he didn't want to be part of the Vietnam soldier bashing that was going on. So the distance he gave it was for his own conscience, but it gave it that amazing timelessness that resonated for the First World War, Second World War, Vietnam War, and then right up until the Malvinas War for this whole new generation, my generation. The song just hit us really hard.
When I was a young man, I carried my pack and I lived the free life of a rover. From the Murray's green basin to the dusty outback, I waltzed my Matilda all over. Then in 1915, my country said, son, it's time to stop rambling, 'cause there's work to be done. So they gave me a tin hat and they gave me a gun and they sent me away to the war.
It was always my proudest moment on stage when he was singing that, to look over at him and see the effect he was having. If you haven't been at a Pogues audience or you've seen film of a Pogues audience, that was not a peaceful folk club crowd. But when Shane Stone Band played Waltzing Matilda, there was silence, it was pin drop. It was so powerful, and he'd sing it that powerfully every night. You know, it wasn't something that would just come and go. It would be like the heart of every performance for me. Funnily enough, that one quiet song just held everyone. It was a very strong moment for us as a band, and I hate to think it will resonate for another generation, but you have to think it will.
Well, how in that hell that they call Suvla Bay, we were butchered like lambs at the slaughter. Johnny Turkey was ready, he primed himself well. He showered us with bullets and he rained us with shells. And in 5 minutes flat, he'd blown us all to hell. Nearly blew us right back to Australia.
James Fernley.
There's something about Eric Bogle's songs that are so unrelenting, with legs gone missing and blood and explosions and eyes out and pity and noise and degradation and despair and all that kind of stuff. Which, when I heard Eric Bogle doing it, there seemed to be, I don't know, something almost indulgent about the imagery. But the way that Shane does it, to me, was all part of the way that he would look at Old Main Drag or Billy's Bones. There was like a measuredness or a dispassion about the way that he came up to his songs, which gives you a bit of space to really consider what he's going on about. And it gives the listener so much more room, yeah, to consider what these things would mean for them rather than what they mean for the person who's telling the story, I guess. It's a lot more of a two-way thing between Shane singing and the person who's listening. It's not minatory and it's not judgmental. It's not belaboring a point, and it's allowing the listener to have an opinion about these things in him or herself.
Go on, sing Matilda. So the green bushes so far and near, for the hang tens and pikes, a man needs two legs. No more waltzing Matilda for me.
Siobhan McGowan.
That's a killer. I mean, that's got to be one of the best Angie Moore songs ever. I'm sure all the band would feel this way, but I absolutely know why Shane Light just is in that song. We shared that. Like, I mean, the First World War is absolutely, that song nails it. Like, you know, really nails it. And the sorrow and the pathos and the way it's so articulated so well in that song, along with the beautiful music, it would have meant an awful lot to him, you know, singing that. It would have been where he was coming from. It probably spoke as much as anything he wrote himself to him.
Back home to Australia. The legless, the armless, the blind and insane, those proud wounded heroes of Sofla. And as our ship pulled into circular quay, I looked at the place where me legs used to be, and thank Christ there was nobody waiting for me to grieve and to mourn and to pity. And the band played
war, fighting, going away, leaving someone, dying, suffering. They are the overall themes of the album, and they are the things that Shane was concerned and consumed with in his mid-20s. So he was a young man who was very principled, very passionate about what he believed, very anti-fascist, cared deeply about the suffering of humanity, thought about it, talked about it, and wrote about it. And you are getting inside in Run, Sodomy and the Lash, the things that did consume him in those days as a young man in his mid-20s, which he was. That's who he was. That's what he was thinking about. That's what he cared about. That's what he wanted to express. He was also obsessed with Ireland. So he obsessed it through Irish mythology and characters and music. And he was also a punk, so he expressed it with anger and venom and passion. So I think that's as good as a praise as I could give you about really where he was coming from on that. That's who he was in those days, you know, that's who he was. He was very, very alive with it, like very vital. He was very vital at that age. And he had a lot to say.
Get fewer, someday no one will march there at all. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, go a waltzing Matilda.
A Dream of Foreign Lands, the story of the Pogues album Rum, Sodomy and the Lash was presented and produced by Mike Glennon. The programme was made with funding from the RTE Independent Radio Productions Unit and from Cumashun na Mban's Sound and Vision Funding Scheme, all made possible by your television licence fee.
You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.